Thank you for coming here. Today, in this presentation, we are going to talk about Entity Framework 6. It's a deep dive, but it's just an excuse to talk about the new features and how we are developing EF6 in open source, in an open source process, and how we are planning to ship it. How many of you attended the talk yesterday about Entity Framework 5? OK. So a little bit less than half of the people. So I want to measure how many people already heard what I said, so I don't repeat too much. So let's start. What happened? Let me try this again. Okay. It's thinking. Sorry about this. I think I have some kind of a network problem. It was making me wait just a few minutes ago. Oh, here it is. OK, so we are going to start talking about the open source process that we are following. How many of you are aware that Entity Framework is now open source? OK, the majority. We are going to talk about some of the features that we are working on for the runtime and the designer of Entity Framework. We are going to demo, especially features in the runtime, because I don't have the preview of the designer here. And we are going to talk about the release details, and we are going to finally talk a bit. I hope we are going to have time to talk about features that we could implement after EF6, and if possible, get some of your opinions and priorities and that kind of thing. Okay, so this is a repeat from yesterday's talk. I just want to set a frame for the talk, and I want to specify why we are developing Entity Framework and why we keep investing on Entity Framework. So for this platform, we want to have a default data access technology that is very easy to use, is flexible enough for most applications, and people really love working with. We want to make the experience of dealing with data, regardless of whether you are creating an application for the client or a service or something, anytime you have to write code that deals with storing data for your application, we want that code to be as easy to write and as easy to maintain as possible. And at the same time, we want the technology to perform and to scale and just to make your life easier. And we think that it's a fundamental piece in the platform. The better job we can do with Entity Framework in general, it's a good thing for the business, it's a good thing for Windows Azure, for .NET, and for you, and for us. So let's talk about open source. We are super happy to be in the open source world. We decided that we wanted to take Entity Framework to open source, I think, about 2 years ago. And it took some time to get there. We joined forces with the ASP.NET team. They were also planning to take MVC4 to open source, and they wanted to develop in an open source environment. And we needed to figure out together a way to basically enable those mechanisms inside Microsoft to be able to develop something using an open source project, and at the same time later be able to release it as a standard Microsoft product with the same level of support that you expect from a Microsoft product. So we joined forces with ASP.NET team and also with a subsidiary of Microsoft that is called Microsoft Open Technologies. And we created this process, and we started the process last year. It has been a nice story for us. It helped us make our processes leaner. We changed a lot how we test our code. We used to have giant test frameworks that we developed in-house. And now we are using standard test frameworks like XUnit. mock and things like that. And now our test code is something that we can share with everybody. It's something that is in the open source repository, and anybody can download the code and can run the test. And that is very good. It used to have, I remember I joined the team more than 5 years ago, and I used to see many cases in which we used to have more bugs in the test framework than in the product. So the other thing is, well, the code is released under an Apache license. That is a very standard license in open source, and anybody can look at it, copy it, do whatever they want with it. Well, I'm not a legal person, so just read the license. But I believe that you are supposed to be able to do all those things. We have nightly builds available in a NuGet feed that is hosted in a different service that is called MyGet. We have a blog post. If you just want to download nightly builds, you can search for our blog post that has all the instructions for that, and it's also in our CodePlex site. We are using Git as a repository, but it's hosted in CodePlex, and we accept contributions. So far, we have had a few interesting contributions, like people that just wanted to look at the code and do some sanity checks and do some cleanup, and other people that wanted to implement features. They were able to contribute those. And we have people that are already working on more sophisticated features, and we keep talking to them. Most of the discussions go through the CodePlex site, and we are using CodePlex also to track all our bugs. So every time anybody files a bug in any other place, we actually move it to CodePlex, and we do all our triages on that bug database. The other thing I want to emphasize is that although we are super happy to be in this process of open source, at the time we release NT Framework 6, it's going to become a standard Microsoft product, and it's going to have a Microsoft license. It's going to have the same kind of support that you expect from a Microsoft product. And we are using a very high quality bar for all the code, our own process, and for all the contributions that we accept. So one of the consequences of being open source is that we change also how we are going to ship the code. To be able to compare, in NT Framework 5, the runtime of NT Framework was divided in two pieces. On one hand, we had the main implementation of things like link to entities and the update pipeline and our mapping technology. They were all part of the .NET framework, part of assemblies like system data entity. And anytime we needed to create a new feature that was cross-cutting or that needed changes to our provider model or anything like that, we basically had to wait for the next version of .NET in order to release that feature. On the other hand, we had this other piece that we built on top of the public API of system data entity that is in our NuGet package. And that is the DB context API and the code first API. And when we started creating that, we realized that it was a very nice way to ship code, much nicer than having all our code in .NET. And the consequence, as I said, is that we had to wait for .NET every time we wanted to ship anything significant. On ES6, things have changed a lot. All the code that we used to ship as part of .NET, we took a copy of that, we moved the classes to a different namespace, and we put it inside the same assemblies that we ship in NuGet. That means that, yes, there are some namespaces changes, so any application that needs to update to NT Framework 6 is going to have to be recompiled. There are a few breaking changes besides the namespace changes, but we are super careful with those. It also means that for tools that have a hard dependency on NT Framework, like profilers, providers for different databases, they are going to have to do more work to update to NT Framework 6. And if they want to maintain compatibility with NT Framework 5, they are going to basically have to have two versions of their product, or at least a facade or something that can isolate the main product from the differences between the two versions of EF. But one of the consequences of this change is also that all the features that we developed for Entity Framework 5 and that used to work only in .NET 4.5 now work with .NET 4.0. So all the support for enums, for special types that we added in .NET 4.5, even the performance improvements, autocompile queries, and all that stuff, now works on .NET 4.0. So what features we have in Entity Framework 6? I could actually have a slide for each of these features, but I don't want to spend too much time on them. Async query and save, that just means that we added async versions of all the APIs that allow you to talk to the database or that trigger operations against the database. That is optimized for the server side, although it's very important to have async support on the client for responsiveness. Our goal has been to optimize for the server, especially because if you use async patterns on the server, you can avoid wasting a thread every time you are blocked waiting for the database to respond. And that can increase scalability of a service or a web application by a big margin. Of course, this leverages the new support for async in the language. So every API that is asynchronous returns a task, and you can await on it. That part is the only difference between our support in .NET 4.5 and .NET 4 in Entity Framework 6. And the reason for the difference is that we depend on async APIs that were added on ADO.NET for .NET 4.5. And we could not implement this feature on top of 4.0. But for everything else, the two assemblies that we have in the NuGet package, the one that is 4.4.5 and the one that is 4.4.0, are the same. The other feature that is very important that we are adding in Entity Framework 6 is connection resiliency. This is basically a way to work with SQL Azure or SQL database for Windows Azure. I don't know how many of you have worked with SQL Azure before. Can you raise your hand? So you are probably familiar with the fact that SQL Azure has some algorithms that are self-defensive and can throttle you if you either your application or some other application that is hitting the same instance is wasting too many resources or using too many resources. SQL Azure can drop the connection at any time as a self-defensive measure. And the other fact is that if you are talking to a database that is in the cloud, your connection is anyway less reliable than if you were talking to a database that is on-premises. So in general, what happens is that if you are using a cloud database, the chances of failure are higher, and it becomes unacceptable for an application to just fail if the connection with the database fails. You need to start handling those kind of errors. And with Entity Framework, but in general with any technology that you could be using, you have to add horrible amounts of defensive code. Every time you talk to the database to do anything, you need to wrap that in a try-catch block, and you need to add some policy to retry, to pull back, wait, and then retry. And if it fails more than n times, then just throw an exception. And that is very, very hard. So what we did in Entity Framework 6 is we basically added code that does that task by default. So every time you execute a query or every time you call save changes, if you configure that you want to work in this mode, we add all the retry logic, and we run the retry logic for you so that you don't need to add that to your code. Another thing that we are adding is a service locator pattern that we use as an extensibility point for many components that are in Entity Framework. For instance, we have a pluralizer service that we use to create the name of an entity set every time you give us a type. And that is a service. That means that you can implement your own version of the service. You just implement an interface and you point us to that interface or to your implementation. It means that you can wrap existing implementations of different pieces inside the framework. And it's a very good interception point. and it's a very good extensibility point. Based on this service locator pattern, we are doing also code-based configuration. So it means, well, you can specify many of the same options that you put in a config file, you can specify on code. We are also improving the API for transaction and for connection management on DB context. What that means is basically that we simplify the pattern. If you want to control, for instance, the lifetime of a connection, and you want to just open the connection and tell us, the default behavior of EF is to open and close a connection every time we use it and we stop using it. If you want to just open the connection and leave it open, you just open it, and now we are going to just honor that. The other thing that you can do now that it used to be impossible is that you can pass an open connection to a context constructor and just make us start with an open connection and we can use it. That enables sharing the connection between multiple contexts also. The other thing that you can do now is initiate a transaction, like a local DB transaction, and tell us about it if you want Entity Framework to use it. And we also created a pattern to simplify doing that using EF. We have a bunch of code-first improvements also. We are adding custom conventions. That means that if you have, for instance, your own convention for naming things in the database, like all your tables start with T underscore, you can write a convention and force code-first to basically name all the tables that way. It's useful for many, many things, but that's just an example. The other thing that we did already is we added support for cat store procedures, so store procedures for updates, inserts, and deletes in code-first. We allow now to customize the history table also for migrations, and we enable also to have multiple contexts with full support for code-first and migrations in the same database. That was one of the limitations of EF5. The other thing that we are working on is more performance improvements. We did a bunch of performance improvements for things like link queries in Entity Framework 5, but now we are paying more attention to some other details. For instance, we have been profiling all the code that we run every time you create a new context. That is important because in web applications and in web services, it's very common to use a session per request pattern. So you need to create a new context to attend every request. And the more overhead we have every time you create a context, the less throughput you can get from the application. So we are reducing that overhead by a lot. It's too early to give you numbers, but we recently made a few check-ins that are improving that, but by a great margin. On the tooling side, we are doing basically two things. One is adapt the Entity Framework 6 designer to work with Entity Framework 6 runtime. In general, the designer is always backwards compatible because it's a component of Visual Studio, and Visual Studio supports multi-targeting. That means that you can create, for instance, in Visual Studio 2012, you can create a .NET 3.5 application, and there is a version of EF there. Therefore, we need the designer to support everything from 3.5, which is EF1, basically, to EF6. And the other main thing that we are doing is try to organize all this constellation of options that you have to create a model. You have code first, you have database first, and model first. We want, basically, that when you say add a new Entity Framework model to an application, you can see a wizard that looks like this and ask you, okay, do you want to go using code or do you want to go with a designer? And then do you want to point us to an existing database or do you want to point us to just create a model from scratch? Okay, so let's go to the demo. For the people that saw yesterday's talk, I'm going to start from the application that I built there, and I'm going to modify it to work with Entity Framework 6. For the people that didn't come yesterday, the application is a very simple application that allows you to find a park near a location. You basically type the name of a location, we call a Bing Maps API to geocode that location. We obtain that, and we do a special search, a special query on the database using a web API service that I developed using Entity Framework. We get the names of the parks, and we basically put them in the map and show the names of the parks. So let's go to that. So this is application. What I basically have here is a couple of classes. I have park and events. I'm using parks only that have a represent parks with IDs, names, descriptions, and locations. And I have a context class and a controller for web API that does all the basic operations. And one of the interesting methods that this controller has is get parts based on a latitude and a longitude that the client is going to use. So let me start the service. And the other thing that I did yesterday is create a Windows Store app that is client for this service. I think the reason this is slow may be the same network issue. Anyway, I'm going to start this. Did this start already? Nope. Okay, so now it started. Okay, so this is what the application does, and it's working, as you can see. So what I'm going to do right now is break it. I'm going to try to upgrade to Entity Framework 6, and we are going to experiment some of the difficulties of doing that. Okay, so this is not really an example of what experience is going to. It's not necessarily an example of what experience is going to be of upgrading to Entity Framework 6, an existing application when we RTM, but it's what it is right now, and we can think of improving the experience a little bit. So what I can do is in this package source, I can run a NuGet command that is update a package. And I'm going to say Entity Framework and preview. If you look at this dropdown, it, instead of pointing to the official NuGet package source, it's pointing to another feed that I have set up here, that is the feed with the nightly builds. That is something that I do here. So I have this feed from MyGet that has Entity Framework preview, like nightly builds, and also MVC nightly builds. So I'm going to get the latest from there. We released Alpha 3 on NuGet, I think it was last week or 2 weeks ago, but we have fixed a few bugs since then, so I'm going to use something that is more recent. Can everybody read all the screen, or is it too small? All okay? People on the back, is it okay? Okay. So what this thing is doing is basically replacing Entity Framework 5 NuGet package with the Entity Framework 6 package, and everything should be fine, right? So I can just try to recompile this. However, it's not fine. And the reason is not that easy is because of the namespace changes that we made. For instance, we used to consider that entity state, that is an enum, was general enough that we put it in system data namespace. And now with the new version of EF, we stopped thinking that that was a good idea. So we moved them to system data entity. So what I'm going to do, I have to do one thing, actually, to solve this problem. And this is something that we may end up doing automatically by RTM. Right now, I have two versions, actually, of entity state. I have the version that is defined in system data entity and the version that is defined in the entity framework.dll that has a copy of all the classes that used to live in system data entity. So the main thing I have to do when I want to upgrade to Entity Framework 6 is make sure that I get rid of this reference completely, because I'm not going to use it anymore. Entity Framework 6 doesn't use, at least it uses .NET Framework, of course, but it doesn't use the EF bits in .NET. So let me see if this is enough. I think it's not going to be enough. OK, the other thing that changed is all the spatial types. Basically, we also thought that it was general enough that we could put them in system data, and now we think that was a mistake, so we moved them under entity also. Should probably compile already. Okay, it compiles. I'm going to start it again. Hopefully, it's going to be faster this time. Okay. And the application is still working. So I'm going to just issue this query again. This is not okay. Okay, now it's up to date. Fine. So what else can we do? We're going to start making use of the new features in Entity Framework. The first thing that I would like to do is to add some store procedure mapping. So let's see how we can do that. I want to add some store procedures to the database, and I created this database using CodeFirst. And I'm using migrations also. So the easiest thing to do is to create a new migration, an empty migration, and basically write my store procedures in the app script. So I'm going to do that. Okay, so I have my code here already written. What you're going to see here is I have very simple store procedures that implement insert, add, update, and delete, and they have the parameters that I would normally expect to see. Like for inserts, I have the name, the description, the location, and the rating for a park. I don't have the ID because it's a store-generated ID. I use an identity pattern to generate it. For the updates, I need the ID because I need to put that in the where clause. And I have basically the new values for all the properties, all the columns. If I wanted to have some concurrency control, I could probably add also a timestamp, and then I would need to have the original value or the value that is supposed to be immutable of the timestamp. And for deletes, I just need to pass the ID. OK, so I can simply say update database. And this is going to add the store procedures in my database, right? Now, the thing is, how do I tell the Entity Framework that I want to use these store procedures now? So the way to do that is very simple in CodeFirst. In the context, I'm going to override the onModel creating method. And here I can tell model builder dot entity of type park maps to store procedures. That automatically is going to tell EF, OK, now look for store procedures with the right signature and with the right names following a convention. And they're going to be there, so just use them every time you need to do an insert, an update, or delete. And the convention is very simple. We say, OK, it's the name of the entity plus underscore insert, underscore update, and underscore delete. And the names are the same names of the properties. So let's try. If I didn't make any mistake, this should work, and I should be able to delete an entity. OK, I'm using Fiddler. This is a tool that allows me to manufacture an HTTP request to send it to the service automatically and also look at the results. And I have this request to make that is a delete verb for HTTP, and I'm passing the URL that identifies one of the resources and the one that I want to delete. And let's execute that. OK, it worked and gives me basically the entity that I deleted. OK, so let me check that I'm not forgetting anything. So what happens if you have a store procedure that doesn't follow the convention? Well, we can try to do that. And what I'm going to do is just delete the store procedures and go back to the previous state of the migrations. So I'm going to say update database, and I'm going to point it to target migration 0. It's basically put the database in the initial state. It's basically empty now. And I want to change, for instance, the name of one of the store procedures, and I want to say this is, instead of being park underscore delete, it's going to be called remove park. And let me update this here also, because I want things to still work. OK, let's go back to this, to the last state. Now I have store procedures in the database that are called like that. OK, park insert, park update, and remove park. So how do I tell entity framework that this name changed and I cannot expect to see a name following the convention? So in this map to store procedures, I have optional parameters. I can pass a configuration object, and I can start doing things. In this case, I want to configure the delete store procedure, so I'm going to use delete. And then there is another configuration here that, for instance, I can use the hasName method and say the name is remove park. I'm not sure if I need to, well, I may need to prefix it with DB or not. Let's try this. Slow. Believe me, it's not entity framework that is slow in this case. Well, let's prepare to. I think if I try to delete the same entity, it's going to work. because I reset the database. And I can put a breakpoint in the meanwhile. So let's go to the controller. Let's put a breakpoint there. Why? It seems that every time I do a 5, it's slower. I'm starting to worry. Okay, it's coming. Okay. So now I can try to execute the same delete. Gives me the breakpoint. Okay, remove park and save changes. Fine, it worked, and if I look at the IntelliTrace, it's going to tell me at some point that it was an invocation to the remove park store procedure, and that's how the delete happened. Okay. And feeder is going to get the response. Okay, so that is what we are adding. The other things that we plan to add in Entity Framework 6 for store procedures is basically an experience in migrations, so that the goal would be that when you decide that you want to map to store procedures and you use migrations, when we scaffold a migration, we create a default store procedure that just works and implements more or less a reasonable way of doing deletes and updates and inserts, and that then you can modify the store procedure to add additional logic or any other thing, any other reason you wanted to use a store procedure. It's up to you what you put there. Finally, the other thing that we want to add for Entity Framework 6, but we are not quite sure that we are going to have enough time, is function imports in general. So the ability to use store procedures and table value functions to read data in code first, or in a model that is created with code first. So the other thing that I can do in this method, I'm going to take the chance since I'm here. I would like to convert this method to async. So it's very simple. This is a standard synchronous method. Let's create the async version of it, or replace it with an async version. I need to use async here and, sorry, make it return a task of whatever the original method returns. And now that I have that, I can use await. And I know that here, for instance, I'm using find to obtain an entity from the database. So this one is an operation in the database on EF, so you can expect that there is going to be an asynchronous version of that. And there is. If I just typed it correctly. And in order to call this method and just await asynchronously, you can use the keyword await now. Okay, here this remove is actually not an operation in the database, it's an operation in memory. So there is no asynchronous version of that, but save changes that comes later is an asynchronous operation. So you can expect to see, sorry, it's a database operation. So you can expect to see an asynchronous version of that and you can await on it. The same. So what can we do? We can try it again. It's a shame that most of my demo is about stopping Visual Studio and then starting again. I know that this entity 5 is already deleted, so I'm going to delete the next one. And I have a breakpoint here. The same method, but now everything is async. Okay, of course, I can do more interesting things with async. Find is a very simple method for doing a query by ID. But of course, there are other ways to write this. So I could say something like where park, sorry. I could do single or default. And what we did is we created async versions of all those extension methods so that it's much easier to use in Entity Framework. So what I do with find is more or less equivalent to doing something like single or default async. And this would work. The other thing that you can do with the async methods for query is if you have a query that potentially returns multiple results, is to use toList async. This is another extension method that we added. That basically is going to return control to that thread or to that code when all the objects are already materialized, and it's going to implement that asynchronously. There is another way to go about it, that is for each async. This is another method that takes a lambda, yes, and it is the equivalent of doing a for each asynchronously. But the idea with this is that now, potentially every row, as you read it, reading every row could be a potentially blocking operation, so you want to read asynchronously. It's just a different option. Now what happens, another feature that we have that could help in this case, if I had this database in a not-so-reliable connection or in a cloud database, is this connection resiliency. Connection resiliency is really hard to demo. So instead of trying to show you the server failing or dropping the connection, I'm just going to debug the code and show you how it's happening. In order to do that, I'm going to basically clone the EF repository. I'm going to get the code for EF using Git. And now it's fast. And I'm going to add this to the project and set a couple of breakpoints and debug it. So in order to enable this connection resiliency, I need to actually configure EF to use it. So I'm going to add a configuration, a code-based configuration to enable it. The right place to put it would be under the model, probably. Say EF configuration, or I don't know, park finder context configuration. And I'm going to make this class derive from DB configuration. And yes, I need this namespace. So this DB configuration, what happens is basically we are going to look in the assembly where you define your context for any type that derives from this class. And when we find one, we are going to use it as the way to configure. So let's add a constructor here. And I can say something like add execution strategy. That execution strategy is basically my retry policy. That's what I'm going to use in order to retry operations that fail with some transient failure against the server. And I have one implementation available in the new SQL server provider for EF. So I'm going to say, I think it's under system data entity SQL server dot SQL Azure execution strategy. I have to say new, of course. So this is using the code base configuration, and this is basically adding one of those services that I mentioned before. Is for the service locator pattern is telling use, okay, instead of using the default execution strategy, use this one that is optimized for SQL Azure and thus retries. So I also happen to know that, this is already downloaded, so I can add entity framework here. I happen to know that when I say changes, the implementation is on object context. So let's look for that class. And there is a method called sageChanges, of course. But there are a few. I'm using the async version, so I could start with this one. And I'm going just to follow the rabbit hole until I find where the actual implementation is. And the actual implementation of this is this method, sagechanges internal async. And here I can see that this is basically instantiating the execution strategy that I just configured using the service locator pattern. And then it's going to use it, basically execution strategy.execute. So I'm going to put a breakpoint here, and then I'm going to try to debug step by step to see what happens. So let's start this. Okay, I'm going to delete yet another entity. Okay, this is my first breakpoint. That's not that interesting. Oh, I forgot to do something very important, actually. So this is not going to ever be hit. The reason is I added entity framework as a project, but I didn't change the reference to point to the source code that I have here, so I need to do that. The easiest way to do that would be to just remove this reference and add it again, pointing to the project. Okay, let's start. Taking more time because it's building entity framework. Okay. It's done building entity framework. It's not that big. As soon as this guy comes back, I can delete 8. Come on. It's not helping. Okay. So again, it hit this breakpoint. I need to hit the other one. Okay, I guess this was some kind of timeout. Ah, no, this is a first chance exception only. Let me change this. Should just work. Yeah. Okay. So I'm about to just go in this method and look at what the implementation does. And this protected execute async is basically the implementation of the retry logic. It's this method that is here. So this basically contains a while loop. It's going to measure how long it's taking to actually do execution, and it's wrapping the execution in a try cache. And it does some crazy things with async just to make it faster. But then, basically, it's going to invoke the function that this execution strategy is getting, and that is going to do the work. And in this case, it's not going to fail, so it will just return without having to do any retries. But if it failed, then it would just keep for a while in that loop doing the retries. If there is a maximum in the default policy, there is a maximum number of retries, and if you pass that maximum, we just bubble up the exception that you got, because it seems that it's not really a transient failure, it's really a permanent failure. But that is how it works. So what else can we do? Another feature that I wanted to demo is, I'm going to remove the red point because I don't want to hit this anymore. Another thing that we can do is use custom conventions for code first. This, I don't want to look at it anymore, but I want to look at my context. So let's add a few more things here. There is a very easy API for custom conventions that is something that we call lightweight conventions. And there is another API that is not so easy to use, and we call it heavyweight, just because the other one is lightweight. And I'm going to demo the lightweight way of doing things. There are two properties now on Model Builder. One is called additional properties. One is called entities, and the other one is called properties. And those are like the entry points for writing those lightweight conventions. I'm going to write one for properties. And here I have two versions of properties, one that is generic and the other one is not generic. And the generic type is just a filter. So I'm going to say I want to write a convention for all properties that are of type string. And I'm going to say something like configure, and then this takes a configuration object that is basically the property configuration, the same one that you would use in the Fluent API when you do modelbuilder.entity of some type.property. And here I can say something like has max length. So what I'm going to do here is basically tell, instead of using the default for all the string properties, that is of use the max, like bar char or n bar char max, make everything maximum 200 characters. And that's all I need to do. Now, if I want to show that this actually is going to change how the database is going to be generated, I can just add a migration. If I could type, that would be good. And migration is going to scaffold how the new database would look like and what are the differences that I need to apply. And what it's doing is basically look for all the properties that were of type string, and it set the max length to 200. So if I update the database, provided that there is no string in the database that is longer than 200, this should just work. This is going to alter table, basically, on all those properties to set the maximum length. Okay, I can also write a more complicated convention, an entity lightweight convention. Let's do that. So let's say that, for instance, I wanted to also map some entities to stored procedures, but I want to invent my own attribute to signal what entities I want to map to stored procedures. So I'm going to do just that. Let's say public class, stored procedure attribute that derives from attribute. It's just a marker attribute that I want to use whenever I want to signal that something is mapped to stored procedures. How do I write that convention? Well, it requires a bit of reflection code because you need to reason about the presence of that attribute in the type, but it's relatively simple to do. For instance, I'm going to start with entities, and I'm going to say where a And what I get here is a type. I'm going to is a type of entity. Basically, this where clause is going to be evaluated for all the types that I believe are entities when I'm doing the building of the model. And I can use a filter expression there. So I can say of type a store procedure attribute any. And I think I probably need to import something here. Oh, I need to say if I want to inherit or not. Okay, so now I have the where condition, and I can filter, and only the types that have that attribute are going to go through the process of configuration. And now I can say what I want to configure. And this is a configuration object. And what I'm just going to specify here is I want to map those guys that have that attribute to stored procedures. And then I can go, if I want, I could go put this attribute on parks. Sorry, the model, I'm looking for the model. Where is it? So I can just mark this type with my new attribute, and this is going to trigger that convention that I just came up with in code first. So that's all for the demo, I believe. Let's go back to the slides. So how we are going to release Sentry Framework 6? Apparently, this thing is tired also. Oh, okay, there you go. So first of all, as I said, we released the Alpha 3 of Entity Framework 6, I think it was last week. And the plan is to keep shipping alphas or eventually betas and release candidates every month or two. And we, of course, have the nightly builds in MyGet. And I can say that, in general, the quality of the nightly builds is quite even. When we break something, it's actually very good because we get a lot of feedback immediately that we broke something, so chances are that we fix it two days later. So I would recommend that if you want to experiment with the Entity Framework 6, you just go to the nightly builds because they are very good. The plan for the tools of Entity Framework 6 is to ship a preview in the next couple of months. We got approval to incorporate the source code of the designer into the same repository that we are using for the runtime. And that is what's going to happen in the next 2 months. We are working on that right now. For RTM, Entity Framework 6 is going to be in the box of the next version of Visual Studio. On the other hand, there is going to be the typical NuGet download in the NuGet gallery. And that version of the runtime is going to work from for every version, basically from Visual Studio 2010 and .NET 4 to the latest. And there is going to be a download, some way to upgrade, basically, the designer in Visual Studio 2012 to the latest version of the designer that supports NT Framework 6. Currently, we are not planning to create a Visual Studio 2010 version of the designer that works with EF6, but you can still use code first in that version. The other thing is that because both the runtime and the designer are completely out of band, we can ship a new version as fast as we can ship NuGet packages, and that is pretty fast. So anytime there is any critical fix for a problem in the runtime or there is an upgrade that we want to release, we can simply release a new version of either the runtime or the designer between releases of Visual Studio. We don't need to wait anymore. So let's talk a bit about potential features for the next version or the next several versions of NT Framework 6. In the title here, I have this shortcut ef.mswish.net. That is basically a redirect URL for our user voice site, where you can find many ideas already that people have voted on, and you can use your own vote to basically win the popularity contest and make us aware that you really want a feature. One thing that we are planning to do, we are very serious about doing this, is to create a PCL version of NT Framework that is going to also incorporate a PCL version of the base classes in ADO.NET. And it's going to work for Windows Store applications, and it's going to use SQLite as the database for local data. What happens later with that, I mean, if there is a possibility that it also works with other databases, that may happen. We are going to keep a provider model, so NT Framework always works with different databases, and we're not going to do anything to prevent that from happening. But in principle, we want to make sure that the experience with SQLite and local data in Windows Store applications is very good. Potentially, we can also support Windows Phone. There is not that much interest on doing that, basically because the phone is a quite different platform. And talking to the phone team, they were not that interested, but we are not also going to do anything that would prevent that from happening. The other feature that we would like to include in the next version of NT Framework after EF6 is batch updates. This is just to clear the confusion. There are two things that people refer to as batch updates. One is actually set-based updates, like the ability to say update, and then in the where clause, instead of passing an ID, say, OK, update everything, or update all the customers that start with A with this change. And that is not what we are planning to do. What we are planning to do is simply to be able to aggregate all the insert, update, and delete statements that we send inside site changes in a smaller number of requests to the server or round trips to the server. So you can assume that, for instance, every 100 updates that we send, we just create one packet with that and we send it to the server in one go. That is usually something that can improve performance and throughput quite a bit on site changes. We actually have a prototype of this. The other thing that we want to keep doing, and this is something that we'll never stop doing, is improve the generation of SQL that we do. Not only how the SQL looks like, how fast the SQL is, but also how it looks like, how simple it looks like, and also how fast we can generate it. One of the things that we want to look at in particular is to finish the optimizations that we were planning to do for the table per type strategy, inheritance strategy. We did some improvements in .NET 4.5, but we didn't finish the work, so we want to do that. The other area that we would like to improve is the mapping between entities and the conceptual model in Entity Framework. There are features that are small, but could make Entity Framework much more flexible. One of them is the ability to map and to materialize to fields instead of properties, and give you more freedom to model your entities in the way you want. For instance, not use a public setter if you don't want to use a setter, or maybe not even use a getter, and let us just use the field when we are materializing the entity. There is somebody in the community that is actually working on making this feature as a contribution, and if he finishes, we can probably have it in EF6 already. The other thing that we would like to incorporate in this more flexible mapping bucket is type conversions, the ability to... The canonical example is to have a column that is a string in the database, but you want to surface that as a bool or as an enum in your entities, something that we don't support right now. And the way we think it would look like is basically you give us a couple of lambda expressions that tell us what conversion to perform on the way in and on the way out for those. Shadow state is basically the ability to track changes and track values for properties that don't exist in your entities at all, but that exist in the database. There are canonical examples for this as well, like, for instance, your entity doesn't have a key. It's maybe a fully contained object inside a collection in a navigation property of another object, and it doesn't have a key at all. But in the database, when we store it, there is a key, and we need to preserve the value of that key when we are tracking the object. Untyped objects is the ability to materialize objects that, instead of being a POCO type, are just, for instance, a dictionary or any type of property bag, and be able to work with those and to refer to properties that are on those in link queries, for instance. And finally, serializing to blob columns is another feature that is common in other ORMs and in NoSQL databases. In general, on EF, we optimize for queryability. So whenever we try to figure out the mapping for an object, we try to shred that object into the different properties, and we always map each property to a column. And if we cannot do that, we just give up, and we either ignore the object or we throw an exception and say, no, we cannot map this thing. So this feature would be to, instead of giving up in that way, we could fall back to a mode in which we just serialize that object into the database in a blob column. And then you keep the ability to persist that object, although you don't get all the flexibility for querying on the database for that object. Finally, lifecycle hooks is basically a number of different interception points for things like queries. Every time we're about to execute a query, you want to modify the query, you could use a lifecycle hook. Or every time we materialize an object, we give you also the opportunity to do something in the object. More flexible link translation. There is a request, a long-standing request, that is about making EF a bit more flexible at the time of evaluating parts of the queries on the client instead of on the server. Like, Link2SQL always had the ability to evaluate things that you put in the projection of the link query on the client. So you can basically put an arbitrary invocation to a function that is only defined on the client in the projection, and Link2SQL will just call it for each row. In Link2 entities, initially, we took a very different approach, and we tried to be purists about the semantics of the query. So we decided, when we designed this, that we wanted to either evaluate everything on the server or throw. If we cannot figure out the translation of something that we see in the expression tree to some piece of SQL or to some fragment of SQL, then we just throw an exception. And the idea is to stop doing that and to be more flexible and to be able to choose which things to evaluate on the client and which things to evaluate on the server. The other thing is something that is possible today. If you have looked at Linkit, there are a couple of classes features in Linkit. One is predicate builder, and the other one is as expandable, that are very clever and allows you to, basically, the idea is to write link expressions dynamically, to stitch together whatever expression you want and then pass it as a predicate or pass it to a link query and expand that expression into the query so that they get executed together. And the idea would be to support that without having to use Linkit. data caching, second level cache, is a very common request for improving the performance and scalability. The idea of having first class support for DDD aggregates. Basically, you define the shape of an aggregate with an aggregate root and some other entities that are part of that aggregate root, and we start doing some things automatically for you. For instance, we can eager load the whole aggregate root always as a rule. We can do delete orphans automatically when you delete the root and things like that. Better support for disconnected graphs. In the past, we added a feature to Entity Framework to the tooling that became very popular that is called self-stacking entities. I don't know how many of you have used that. Okay, not so many. They became very popular, but they were a bit messy and complicated. Even the code was everything, a T4 template that generated some crazy amount of code. And it was almost the opposite of POCO. It was code that you would never want to look at, basically. Not only you would never want to write that code, but you would never want to read it. What we would like to do is to enable, again, entire development with Entity Framework, but in a cleaner way that uses POCOs and that can reason better about what is the right state for this part of the graph based on what is the current state in the database, or based on keeping the copy of the original graph that was retrieved from the database before. Another feature that we are thinking about is SQL federations. The ability to do sharding with EF. Right now, it's possible with the number of workarounds to get this working, but it's not really a nice experience. So we would like to add some improvements in this area. Another feature is microRM capabilities. Right now, microRMs became very popular after some team at Microsoft started building one and then got completely defenestrated by the community, especially by the DDD community. The community also started creating microRMs that allow you to just pass a SQL string and materialize an object out of it, or pass an object and just create a very dirty and quick update statement for it. And we have some of those capabilities already. If you look at the database object, the database object that you get from context.database, there is a SQL query there that allows you to pass just a native SQL query and get materialized objects. So we would like to improve in that area, basically to add a one object at the time, update, insert, and delete, and also to support dynamic objects. But it's completely separate from the rest of Entity Framework. It wouldn't go through all the mapping layers that we have in Entity Framework and all the more sophisticated mapping technologies that we have. Unique constraints is a long-standing ask also, and we actually had a quite finished prototype of this, but we stopped developing that. It became not so much a priority, but we still hear from people that they want it. Query hints, the ability to do like log hints or query hints in general to use a specific index, and anything else you want. Is there anybody that has a question about this or that would like to see something that is not in the list? No? Okay, I don't see anybody raising a hand, so. These are a few links, resources, to learn about EF. We have this MSDN documentation that is very good and it's improving all the time. We have our CodePlex site. Actually, I would like to show you a bit of that CodePlex site. So the way this is organized is that you are going to get some introduction here about the process and some easy steps to get the code and to build the code, how to get the nightly builds, and how to contribute. These are all links. There is another part that is interesting, of course, the source code and the history. You can see that every day we have several check-ins in general. And all the descriptions are usually interesting if you are a nerd or a geek like myself. We have this area of documentation that contains more details about how to get the code and how to build it, how to run the tests, and how to contribute. And inside the roadmap, we have feature specifications and design meeting notes. We actually have a weekly design meeting in which, of 2 hours, in which we discuss pending issues with the design. And recently, we started inviting people from the community to attend, people that happened to be in Redmond. So it was interesting to have them there and to present their proposals. The feature specifications list is basically the complete list, even more complete than what I had in the slides, of all the things that we are adding in EF6 and some other things that we would like to do later. And I don't know why this is not responding. Same issue again. Well, the design meeting notes are also very, very interesting if you are into ORMs and into software design in general. You can probably read our minds and see how we think and how much we care about even the naming of an API and all that. It's very interesting to watch, especially if you are there. But in the notes, you probably can see some of that. OK, this is not responding, so I'm going to give up on it. So finally, again, the user voice site, ef.mswitch.net, and some links to follow us if you want to follow us on Twitter or Facebook or in our blogs. I don't blog a lot, and I don't tweet a lot, but I still have those accounts, too. They are there. Does anybody have any question? That's all I have for today. Thank you, guys.